Okay, so let's get started then. Okay, so you have already heard quite a lot about symbols, so I'm not going to really introduce you what they are, unless people insist on it. So basically, just very quickly what they are. So it's basically some algebraic avatar for polylog. If we say polylog, we basically say integral. So if you have our integrals, or loop integrals, and we have functions that come out, and those are very often polylogs, then the symbol is, you can say, something in between. It's not a full function, but it captures the essentials of it. And basically, roughly speaking, what it does is it resolves all the complicated functional equations that exist among the polylogs. So basically, it's an algebraic calculus, a tensor calculus, that captures the functional equations in here. So I'm not going to introduce you too much to it, because there were, 2 days ago, Mark gave a good review of how the symbol works. So what I will concentrate on is actually roughly the function side. So basically, given the symbol, how can we turn it into a function? So in other words, you can think of it in two ways. So either someone hands you a symbol that corresponds to the integral you want, how can you get the function out? Or you have an integral, you compute it by whatever means necessary, you get complicated functions, and you can ask yourself the question, can I simplify it? Can I write it in a simpler way? And then you can go through the symbol, which resolves all the relations among the functions, among the polylogs, and you have a hope to get a simpler function out. And so just before starting, since we're concentrating on the function side, so I put here basically the actors that enter the game. So I will leave this on during the talk, so you can, at any point, if you forgot a certain definition, you can just look at it. Just to remind you what we're talking about, but I guess what everybody's used to is the classical polylog, which is just iteratively defined at weight n of an integral of the weight n minus 1 quantity divided by t. If I do this integral, I get the next polylog. So I get LL2, LL3, and so on and so forth. So this is, however, not enough to get all the integrals. We need more. They were also already introduced by Mark 2 days ago. They're called multiple polylogs, Gontrov polylogs, various names. So now, instead of this just an index n, I have now n complex numbers, if you want. And what I do is, instead of just integrating in more and more 1 over t's, I integrate in more and more 1 over t minus something. So it's, you can see this as the particular case where a1 is equal to 0, for example. And so this basically spans in a much larger space of functions. The problem being that, obviously, while these have been studied very well, we know their functional equations, here you basically enter a wave new world. So you need a whole new machinery to tackle them. Just quickly, what are the properties of these functions? So this is an equation that you have already seen a couple of times. It's the differential equation for multiple polylogs. Just says if we take the total differential, total meaning with respect to z, but also with respect to the inner ones, then what I get is it reduces the weight, transcendental weight, or transcendental degree by 1. So I get another multiple polylog where I delete one of the entries, and I get a d log in the end. And if you remember Mark's talk, there's, in some sense, you can see it as the definition of the symbol. So the symbol, how you could define it is to say, the symbol of this function is the symbol of this thing tensored with d log of whatever it is.
By the way, why does the total derivative not have a time dependent EZ?
Well, I mean, I could write this as, well, okay, I should say here that AN plus 1 is Z. Here, Z, here, okay? You see, if the sum goes up to N, the negative term AN plus 1, which is identified with Z. Okay, so that this gives you the dz term. Okay, so let's have a much more structure to them. Maybe some of you are familiar with these structures, some are not, so let me just quickly recall it. It said these functions form an algebra. So you can multiply them, and they are closed under multiplication. So what do I mean by this? It means if I take, say, for example, two-way two objects, so we have way two because I have two A's, the last one doesn't count. If I multiply them, I get a weight four function, well, actually a combination of them. And, well, it looks messy, but it's not. It's just all possible ways of commuting A1, A2 through 3 and 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 3, 2, 4, 1, 3, 4, 2, and so on and so forth. So all possible ways of commuting one block through the other. It's called a shuffle. Okay? The last property I will need during the talk is that they also have a nice series representation. So far here in this workshop here, I've only heard about the integral representation. There's also a nice series representation, which is this one, which is usually, if you talk about the series, you write them in this way, it's a detail. But it's in fact the same thing. You can just convert from these Lie functions to the G functions. And this is just some notations, because we have lots of trailing zeros. So just put some indices that tell me how many zeros come before a given argument. Okay, it's just notation. The interesting thing is that in the series representation, there's another algebra hidden, an independent algebra, which now, for example, says if I multiply Lie 2 and Lie 3, I get a Lie 2, 3, a Lie 3, 2, and a Lie 5, which is 2 plus 3. It's called a Stuffle algebra.
Does this algebra hold for all branches?
This, I think, holds for all branches, yeah. Okay? So, now assume you have a complicated function, complex combination of these, and you want to simplify it. Okay? So the first thing you can do is you can take its symbol. According to the prescription that Mark gave you, symbol of this equals symbol of this tensored with this. Okay, for example, symbol of Lie 2 of x is minus 1 minus x tensor with x. So to each polylog I can associate a tensor. And also this algebra structure carries over. When I get and take the symbol, say, let me write this as a vector, so just a sequence of these indices, z, and I have another vector of indices, z, what I get is, let me first write it and then I explain. Well, I can even allow to take different ones. They must not be the same as in that case. Okay, so what does this symbol here mean? It just means, again, shuffle. So remember that this symbol is a tensor, so it has various slots, and I just shuffle them through in the same way as I did here with these. So for example, well, just to fix the idea, if I have A tensor B shuffled with C tensor D, it will just be again like this. A tensor B tensor C tensor D plus A tensor B, A tensor C tensor B tensor D, and so on, just like the other side for the A's.
What do you do when the arguments are not the same?
It still works. Here they don't need to be the same. You can see it because, well, it's a property I didn't give. these things are something scaling variant. I could divide both sides. I could always write this as like this. This is an allowed operation. Well, let's do not talk about details, but roughly speaking, you can do this, and then it would be the same. But even if they are not the same, you can show that at the level of the symbol, this is a true, is allowed. Even though at the level of the function, it would not be allowed.
Perhaps you could point out more generally, I mean, that the symbol of the product of any two functions is given by this.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Yes. I mean, but that follows just because it's linear and then you expand it out. Okay? So, I have now a symbol which would just be a tensor. How can I find a function it corresponds to? So, let's get really started. It was just some definition. So let's assume someone hands you a symbol S, which I can generically write like this. Okay, it's some linear combination of tensors. So these objects here are rational coefficients, say. And what are these pi's? Entries in the tensor. So the pi's, they are, as Mark explained, the symbol is an element of the multiplicative, the n-fold tensor product of the multiplicative group of rational functions. So it's just another way to say that each slot in the tensor sits a rational function. Okay? And so that's basically the assumption that from now on I will use, that these objects are rational. In practice, if you have integrals, Feynman integrals in particular, you might also get square roots. In that case, what you need to do is you need to find a parameterization that gets rid of the square root. So you might need to find a reparameterization that makes the square root rational. So let's assume from now on that the pi's are rational.
So at some point, the coefficients were rational. You meant
yes.
Rational numbers?
Yes.
Rational numbers.
No, rational numbers.
And how do you know they're just rational numbers?
Well, let's say this is the form that is given to me. If it's really just a combination of polylogs, it will be rational numbers. Okay. Otherwise, you have to deal with quantities that have. Well, it means that the function already has rational pieces. Okay. So, if you remember from Mark's talk, the symbol behaves in each slot as a logarithm. So this means that if I have a symbol that has somewhere inside a product, it just behaves as a log. It just means that I can replace the product by a sum. Okay? So for this reason, I can equally well assume the pi's are polynomials. Okay, I just expand everything out. They're just polynomials. And I can even assume more. I can assume them to be irreducible. So no longer factorizable. And in fact, over z. So they are just, I start off with rational function, say with rational or integer coefficients. And so I factor them until they become irreducible over z. So for example, 1 plus x squared is considered irreducible. Okay? So that's basically the input we are given. Now what we want from this is, let's use some colors. Want a function now, f of some variables, which are the same variables that appear in these polynomials, such that the symbol of this function is just S. Note that there can be more than one function, okay? So I'm not, since probably the unitarity boundaries become tighter, let's discuss a function that has this property. Let's find a function. Okay? So how can we do it? Well, so as I said, by assuming these things to be rational numbers, basically I implicitly assumed that this function is a linear combination of polylogs. That was implicit in this assumption. So I can already assume can be written as some linear combination, let's say like this, of say polylogs, some polylogs, and the arguments are rational functions. And these quantities are again rational numbers. Okay? So far I haven't done much. So let's inject this here. So then this equation just reads like this. Okay, the symbol is linear, so I just pull it through the sum and the coefficients, and I end up here. So now, another trivial observation, this whole thing is some equation that lives in some vector space. Okay, it's an equality between two tensors, an equality between two vectors. Okay? So that means that finding the coefficients is just linear algebra. I have two vectors, and I want them to be equal. I have to find coefficients such that they are equal. So that's also easy. But now you see where the bottleneck is. So the real question is, what are the PIs and what are the RJs? If I have PI and RJ, I can just compute the CIJs by solving a linear system. And so basically, that's what the talk is going to be about. Okay, so there will be roughly two parts, an easy part, which is finding the PIs, and a difficult part, which is finding the RJs. Difficult. You'll see. Okay, so let's start with the first part, which is what you could call types of functions. So by types of functions, I mean the PIs. Okay, so, well, we assumed it was a function of polylogs. So let's write down the polylogs we know. So at weight 1, so I'm going to make a table. Weight versus function. So at weight 1, well, I have my ordinary logarithm. And I can also take some others. So that would be Li 1. At weight 2, you can just read it off there, it would be Li 2 and Li 1 1. At weight 3, you just go on, there would be Li 3, Li 1 2, Li 2 1.
You're implicitly including all products of lower weight functions?
Yeah, so it can, so for example, if I want something of weight 3, say, then it can be these. Or products of 2 times 1 or 1 times 1 times 1.
Is it actually for any given S that such an algorithm can always succeed, namely that you can always find the collection. I guess you'll talk about the RJs later.
Yes, you will see there's one point where you have to make an assumption.
Okay. Because generically, I might think that I would have to allow polylogarithms with algebraic functions, not rational functions, inside the argument.
As I said already, in that case, you have to assume that you have found a parameterization that gets rid of the square root. So.
No, but what I mean is, even if I give you a symbol S,
yes,
where there are no square roots,
yes,
in general, it's not clear to me that it can always be written as a sum of polylogarithm functions with no square roots inside the polylogarithm. But maybe.
Okay. Well, is that that is an assumption that has to be made in the next when they talk about the RJs.
I can make a trivial observation that if you pick one variable, you said you have all your polynomials irreducible.
Yes.
But let me pick one variable. I can always factor, if I have a polynomial of degree n in some variable z,
yeah.
I can always factor it into z minus a1 times z minus a2. A1 and a2 will then be algebraic functions of the remaining variables.
No, I assume that there are polynomials in all variables.
No. I know, but you can only. Okay, never mind.
Then it would not be polynomial in all variables anymore.
I know. We can discuss later. Yeah, I know.
Okay, so let's continue the enumeration of these functions. And so on. Well, can go on. 5. You have V5, you have 4-1, V4-1, and so on. Well, let's write some more, which I need. 2-3, V3-2, and so on. Okay. So those would be all possible functions you could think of. The problem is not all of them are independent. I mean, many of them can be automatically rewritten in terms of the others. So a good thing is already to know which ones you want to keep, which ones you don't want to keep. And, well, there is a conjecture, at least I was told by the mathematicians that there's a conjecture by Goncharov and Zagier, which says that all the Lies that have somewhere inside a 1 are not independent. Okay, so what does it mean, for example, for this table? It means that I can remove V1 because it's just a log. At way 2, I can remove V11. At weight 3, it can remove 1, 2, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1. Weight 4, I can remove 3, 1, 1, 3. But I have to keep V2, 2, and you can show that the others also gone. At weight 5, you can easily check that everything dies except these two.
Because V2, 2, using the Stifler, if I take the product of 2, V2,
no. You see that it's xy plus yx in the Stoffel. So if I multiply two L2s, I get the L2xy and the L2yx, which are not the same. I mean, what you want to do is you want to say, you want to do L2x times L2y, right?
Yes.
So let's write out the Stoffel. L22xy plus L22yx plus L4xy. Okay? And you see that I cannot disentangle the two L22s.
Is it issue?
The conjecture just says that at least I can.
You can always get rid of it.
Yes, and in fact, it's a good point you made, because at weight 5, this is indeed true. I don't need both of them. Because at weight 5, I can indeed do this. you see, now I can trade Li 3-2 for Li 2-3. Which I could not do here. So here I can get rid of this one. But Li 2-2 I have to keep. Okay? So this gives a good answer for the PIs are. So it gives a set of a search space for the PIs. So now we need the RJs. So let's start with the arguments.
So in finding additional relations, it's sufficient to use the supple algebra, or you need to use all the
You probably need more. I mean, I don't say that the stuffle is enough. At weight 5, the stuffle gives the answer. I mean, the conjecture just says that those with 1 are not independent.
I realize that, but I'm saying, ideally, presumably for this procedure, you want to have as minimal set as possible.
Yes. I will come back to what minimal means in the end. Because also with the argument, it's the same problem. You can have a redundant set of arguments.
Saying
you need to use the stuffle to remove additional ones. Okay. And so now here comes in this assumption I was talking about, and probably also Mark's comment. So here I have to make an assumption. Which is that, now why it is in red, because it is an assumption, I don't have a proof that this is always true. The symbol contains the information I need. So that's an assumption I make. Because if that's not the case, then obviously an algorithm cannot succeed. If I need to add in additional pi's in this case, then now the computer cannot succeed. Computer cannot guess what is missing. So,
I think my question was, it's not obvious to me that even if I give you a symbol, all of whose entries are polynomials, that there has to exist a linear combination of polylogs whose arguments are all rational that has that symbol.
But if you have such a combination, so I don't, maybe you have an example, I don't know.
I'm gonna try hard to find an example.
Okay, because if there was such an example,
yeah.
I could take its symbol, which would mean that the pi's would already be algebraic functions.
But it could, the symbol could be a sum of many terms?
Yes.
Such that when you combine them, say you get 2.
Absolutely, groups. And then it violates this assumption here that the symbol gives me all the information I need. Then I have cancellations.
Okay.
Then it means that there are pi's, additional pi's you need, which are not present in this expression.
In a sense, actually, the format box is kind of an example of what you're talking about.
Well, but then as I said, find the parameterization,
yeah,
such as the square root, yeah, for example, yeah. So, to answer your question, I assume that the pi's, if there are cancellations among different things, the algorithm cannot succeed because the computer will never find these additional pieces. Okay. So, where was I? Yes. So I make the assumption that the symbol contains what I need. So what does it contain? Well, it contains these coefficients, but the coefficients are already doomed to fix these coefficients here. So what I'm left with is now what goes into the polylogs, so the pi's. So let's define P equal to the set of polynomials. And I define out of this a new set, P bar, which is, let me first write what it is and then give an example. It's in fact very easy, but it sounds complicated. closure under pi to 1 minus pi. So what does it mean? Well, let's take an example. And I give a longer detailed example at the very end. When I take p equal to x, say 1 minus x and 1 plus x, then I can compute 1 minus x, which is x, and I can compute 1 minus 1 plus x, which is minus x. So I get something that I didn't have before. So I have to include it. And this one, I also get something I didn't have before, but this one is identified with x because I always assume that I factor everything. So whatever I get here, I factor it completely, and I just look at the prime factors, and I include them into this set here. So here, p bar is x, 1 minus x, 1 plus x.
There's some canonical choice of whether you have 1 minus x or x minus 1?
It doesn't matter, because remember that the symbol is insensitive to the sign I put here. Okay, so it doesn't matter what I choose.
These prime factors, the prime number is e, right?
Yes, yeah.
Half x, that would.
Yes, that one would, yeah, you would have to keep it in the sense that, for example, the symbol would forget a half, so better keep the 1/2. Well, there are other ways you could view it. You could go to, there's another way of dealing with the symbol where you keep the constants, but. Let's stick to the conventional definition. Okay? So, now let's try to construct rational functions that produce pi's, as many pi's as possible. Well, the easiest way to do it is to look at objects of the form that are constructed out of these elements. And I can also put a sign and those objects are integers. So let's call this R. Okay. So this is lots and lots of rational functions that, when I put them into slots of the symbol and expand them out, give me pi's. There are, however, far too many. Because, well, let's take one of these functions. So let's take a similar phi 2. And you see that in the second slot, indeed, I can now factor out all these pi's. So I get all these pi's that I need. But in the first slot, I might get stuck, because I have 1 minus. So if I want this thing to be a good argument, what I have to require is that 1 minus r again factors in the same way. Otherwise, I will not be able to get there. OK? So if something is not clear, please tell me. So let me define r1 as being the set of all of these functions in this set here, such that 1 minus this function is again factored in the same way. And so this space, it's now a good set to look for the RJs. Because those are the ones that give also pies in the first slot.
This set, I mean, the first set is an infinite set.
Yes.
And this set is typically now a finite set?
In the cases I played with, it was always finite. It can be
no
big. No, no. I will give you an example. You will see that, it is relatively small.
The 1 minus lot came about because you need 2.
Yes. So this, okay, this is, that's why I call it R1. This is for the classical polylogs. I will also generalize it to the multiple ones. Let's first discuss the classical ones. Okay, and let's first discuss the properties of this set.
So in practice, when you're constructing this set, it's sufficient to count up to some point n where you get convergence of R1?
Yeah, exactly. So in practice, well, I will discuss it, but the idea is in practice, basically, you do kind of a Laporta thing. You don't expect x to the 80 divided by 1 minus x to the 90 in practice. So you sample through it until you get convergence, either because the set, well, you don't find anything new, or you already found a function. Because you don't expect, so basically, you can classify them according to the sums of the powers. Okay? So if I call n the sum of these n pies, you don't expect n, oh, the absolute value rather. You don't expect n to be 1,000 in practice for the things we're interested in. So it's kind of a Laporta approach in that sense. Okay, so let's discuss the structure of these sets a little bit. I think the first thing it's easy to see is that this set is a group. Okay? If I multiply two functions of this type, I get a function of the same type. So this thing is a group. This set is not. Because if I multiply two of them, in general, 1 minus the product will no longer factorize. However, there is a new structure that arises here, which is there's an action of the symmetric group F3 on R1. So what do I mean by this? Let's consider this following set of transformations. Which one I'm missing? This one. And sigma 5 is this one. So let's consider the following set of transformations. You can easily check that this is just an action of S3. Now, the claim is that the set R1 is closed under this action. So why is that? Well, it's easy to prove, in fact. So first, S3 is generated by cyclic rotations and reflections, by these two. And, well, so it's enough to show that it's closed under these two. It's closed under 1 minus R by definition. And for the other one, if I compute 1 minus sigma 2 of R, I get 1 minus 1 over R, which is minus 1 minus R times R minus 1. But by hypothesis, this thing is again factorizable, and this thing is as well. Yes? So this means that whenever I take a function in this set and I do any of these transformations, I get another function of this set. So this is very useful in practice, because it means that if you find one candidate argument, you get 6. You just construct the whole orbit. Conversely, because you have to test all of these objects in here, roughly speaking, if you find one that doesn't satisfy this constraint, you get 5 more that don't satisfy the constraint. Because if one element of the orbit is not in R1, the other five cannot be either. So this allows you to speed up the construction of the set R1. Okay? So then, to come back to David's comment, so this was the case for the classical ones. So how does it look like for the multiple ones? The picture just generalizes. So if I take, for example, the symbol of, and I use our dissertation G22, which is just the same as V22 of two conventions, then, well, I'm not going to write a symbol because it's pretty long, but the slots in the symbol are R1, R2, 1 minus R1, 1 minus R2, and R1 minus R2. And so you see that, well, but it's again the same story. If I want everything to factor into pi's, what I want is I want each of them to factor into pi's. So the search space for depth 2 object is just pairs of objects that I already had in here because of this condition. And I must now require the difference, again, to be factorizable. OK? So it's just R1s because of this, and the difference must also factorize. One good thing about this is that you see that once you have R1, R2, you just get smaller. You impose more constraints on it, but you don't go, you don't get new rational functions once you have R1. Another thing, so what does this symmetry become? Because symmetry helps you a lot in constructing the set. So in fact, it turns out that in this case, it is S3 equals S2. So what is this S3 and this S2? So this S2 is just swapping the two, because you see that the constraint here is up to sine left unchanged. And this F3 is just a diagonal action on these pairs. So this sends, say, R1, R2 to, say, sigma I, where sigma I is one of these. Say, rho 1, where rho is one of these guys. Sigma I, R rho of 2. And then again, it means that as soon as you find 1, you find 6 by just closing the orbit. This can be very helpful, as we'll see in the example. And this just goes on like this. We can now construct RK, which is just K tuples of elements in R1. Such that now all the differences must factorize. This goes on the same way, and the symmetry is now S3 cross SK. And then you see that, in fact, here the fact is it was an S3 was just an S3 cross S1, in fact. So this is just a general form of the search space. So this means that under this assumption that the slots in the symbol are enough to find a function and that the arguments are rational, you can construct sets that factor into these pi's. In particular, you see that all the steps are easily computerizable. So what do you need? You need to get these objects here, which basically means you have to take some integer number and partition it in all possible ways to get your test functions. So that's partitioning, constructing partitions. That's something a computer can easily do. Might be slow, but computer does it. You need to test factorization. It's again something computer algebra program can do. And in the end, once you have it, you write down a general ansatz and you have to solve a linear system. It's again something a computer can do. Okay? So before turning to the example, yes, I have 15 minutes, it's good. Just one thing. So this set contains more arguments than you need in general. For example, you see from this one, it contains all the 1 over r's. But we know that polylogs in x and polylogs in 1 over x are related. So you get more objects than you need. So if you include all of them in your ansatz, you basically over-constrain it. But that's not a problem, because it's just linear algebra. It will tell you that the solution space you get is non-trivial. So you get coefficients that are not fixed. Okay, so you could choose various, you have three coefficients you can choose. This freedom is just the functional equations that you have among your basis functions. Okay, because I could have chosen to use a functional equation to transform one basis function to another, and that's the freedom that's left when you solve this linear system. Okay? At the same time, it means that it's also very algorithmic to find minimal set. Because again, if I have this set, I can construct basis functions. If I have basis functions, I can just check for linear independence. I can remove one of them and ask, can I write it in terms of a linear combination of the others? If so, then it means that I find a solution. If not, it means the system doesn't give a solution. And then in the end, you end up with a minimal set. It also tells you if this assumption is not satisfied, because it simply means that the system can never be fulfilled. So if there is a pathological case that doesn't converge, you will also get it, because it simply means that the linear system is not solvable within this class of functions you have constructed. So there's also kind of a bound that you don't run out of you burn your CPU. Okay.
Is it interesting? Is there any point in imposing some condition like you want? What does minimal say?
Minimal means, so such that there are no functional equations left among them. Okay, for example, I don't want dialog of x and dialog of 1 over x at the same time. I may want it. Okay, so that's also a personal choice. Another condition you might impose is if you know that the function you're after is real, you might want to choose the representatives in this orbit to be those that make your dialog real.
I guess what I'm saying is minimal doesn't seem to mean that you want the fewest number of terms.
No. Minimal means in some, it's, let's call it, it is really this fact that there is a non-trivial solution space, okay? It is literally this.
I think maybe what you mean to say is a basis that's not overcomplete.
Yes, yeah.
So to what extent was the 27-page thing overcomplete?
It was in the sense.
Just that you used. It may be that I get a polylogarithm.
Exactly. It is maybe a personal choice. Maybe you find out that you don't need multiple ones. It's enough that you choose LF4s.
Right.
That's something I don't have the time to go into.
Right.
There's also a way that you can, for example, distinguish. For example, say you have something of weight 3, okay?
Yes.
There's a way to tell a priori whether there will be 3 or not.
But still, what I'm saying is, it may be that you have two equivalent expressions, each of which are minimal according to the sense that what is contained in each of these expressions separately cannot be, there are no further identities just among each expression. But one of these expressions takes 2 lines and the other expression takes 27 pages.
Yes.
and they're equivalent.
They are equivalent because numerically they give the same answer. But you might, for example, well, it's just, it's aesthetics, right? I mean, you might want to choose only nice arguments. You might see that, for example, certain objects that you, for example, you might see in the end that you might only need a subset of the pies to get to the answer. There may be the arguments that, well, that you need less arguments than you actually thought in the beginning. Okay, that's what happened with the 27 pages. You had lots of multiple polylogs. It was the same function, but you could write it with a smaller set of functions. But that's also a personal taste. That's not some mathematical wigger. The mathematical wigger was like the fact that you get then, you are left with a non-trivial solution space here. This parameterizes all the relations that are left. Another thing is, for example, if what comes out contains functions, well, you could have what comes out complicated G's, but in the end, you can package them into just leaf 4 and leaf 2. But when you look at the 17 pages, there were G's with very complicated arguments. But you can package them into leaf 4s and leaf 2s. So you need less arguments. That's a personal, that's a matter of personal taste. Okay. So 10 minutes is enough time to give an example. This was a lot of theory. Okay, let's take a symbol S is this one. And those of you that were at Nastia's talk remember it. That's the example she gave. S symbol sometimes being tricky because let me just do it manually. Because I can write this like this, and just wrote this one in this way. Then the symbol behaves as a log, so get this. And I can also write this as 1 over 3, 1 minus x cube, tensor x cube, minus 1 minus x, tensor x. And so this, you can now identify with the symbol of v2 x cubed plus v2 of x. So it is just, this is what we want in the end. So can we do it in an algorithmic way without having to do this clever step here? Because that's the bottleneck. So, okay, let's go to this procedure. So let's first look. What are the prime elements? Well, there were two. And now I want its closure. So I need x to 1 minus x. So that's already a new one. And I have 1 plus x squared goes into 1 minus 1 plus x plus x squared, which is minus x times 1 plus x. So the sign is irrelevant. X I already have. The new one is 1 plus x. So p bar is 1 plus x squared, x, 1 minus x, 1 plus x. Okay? So the functions here, that's very easy. There's only log and v2, so you don't have to dwell long on the functions. So let's directly go.
Just in general, if so when you look at closure under one,
yeah,
and you find that the answer factorizes and you include particular factors,
yes,
do you also in general need to check that those things, those factors are themselves then closed under?
Yes, yeah. It's really the closure, so you have to check it again. Yeah, this 1 plus x again gives minus x. But, yes, indeed. You need a closed set. Because you could always get in 1 minus and so on. This 1 minus operation is everywhere. Okay, so, well, you can just now construct a set R. Well, at least formally, and what it is, it's just plus or minus x to the alpha, 1 minus x beta, 1 plus x gamma, 1 plus x squared delta, functions of this type. And now, well, let's, as we did there, let's define n to be this. Okay? And let's decompose R1 and so on. Okay? Just to, according to the sum of the powers. Then you can ask the computer, say, construct R1, and what it will give you is just, in this case, it's P bar, obviously because it was closed, you get one new thing, which is minus x. Okay? Plus, I don't write them here, because otherwise, plus inversions. By inversions, I mean you also get minus 1 over x, and you also get 1 over each of these. Okay, so in total, how many elements are there in R1? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, plus all the inverses, 10. Let's ask the computer to construct part 1, 2. So here the list gets longer, you get x squared. You get x over x minus 1. You get x over x plus 1. You get 1 minus x squared. You get minus x times 1 plus x. You get 1 minus x cubed. You get, now comes the fancy stuff, x over 1 plus x squared. And you get 1 plus x over 1 plus x squared plus 1 over each of these. How many there are? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times 2 means 18. Yes, sorry. Can construct R13. You get x cubed minus x squared over 1 plus x. X over 1 plus x squared. X squared over 1 plus x squared. 1 plus x squared over 1 plus x squared. X 1 plus x over 1 plus x squared plus the inverses. And two more, our 4 1 is x squared over x squared minus 1. Our 5 1 is x cubed over x cubed minus 1. Our 6 1 it's R7-1, it's R8-1, it's empty. So obviously it's not excluded that R100 is again not empty, but at that point it stopped. When it spit out 3 of them that were empty, I decided it was enough. Here I didn't count as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times 2 makes 12. here, well, again, yes, but this is two. This is two. So how many there are?
What do you mean?
So R12 is just all possible functions where the sum is equal to 2.
So what about taking delta equals 2 and the others equal 0?
Yes, but you have to satisfy the constraint. Yes, but delta equals 2, yeah. Let's try it. That would be a possibility, because you see, for example, x squared is here. So you want this function here, okay? But it must satisfy the constraint. When I take 1 minus this function, it factors into the same object. Okay? So that's what the computer does. It tests whether this constraint is satisfied. Okay? You see, for example, here, alpha equals 2 was possible because obviously 1 is x squared factors. So how many there are? So 26, 38, 42, which I can also write as 7 times 6. And so what is this 7 times 6? Well, it's just the orbit. Oops, not this one. This one. Just the orbit of S3. So in particular, it means that I would not have had to go to here. As soon as I had x cubed, I could have known that in R5 I would find x cubed over x cubed minus 1. So, in fact, in constructing all of this, I did too much. It would have been enough to find 7 of them. And this would have closed the whole thing already. Okay? So now, obviously, you also see, it's very easy now, there is an x cubed. It's the important part, and in here, you have an x. So if I just write the general ansatz for all of these arguments, I will indeed find this function as a solution. But here I will find more. Again, there will be a non-trivial solution space corresponding to, for example, for the dialogue of x and the dialogue of 1 minus x are related. But that's just a redundancy that's left. I could check using the same strategy and kill all of those that are redundant. In particular, at way 2, you just need 1 representative for each orbit. So this would bring it down to 7 arguments already. Very few of them would now be related, and then the algorithm would directly turn just this expression. Okay? Okay, so I just made it 3 minutes over the unitarity bound.
That's very good. Okay, any more questions or comments? Okay, well, thanks a lot. Very good. Start programming.